From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. A busy week for President Barack Obama. He addresses a joint session of Congress, unveils his health reform package, sets a date for combat troop withdrawal from Iraq, and issues a $3.5 trillion budget. How successful will he be with such an ambitious agenda? Meanwhile, across the aisle, Republicans gather this weekend to select an early party favorite as a possible challenger for the White House in 2012. Who will that be? It's Friday and time for Reporters Roundtable. Joining us today are Sharice Jones, a national correspondent for USA Today, and Aaron Aubrey Kaplan, a freelance writer and a contributing editor to the opinion page of the LA Times. Sharice, Aaron, nice to have you back.
Oh, thanks for having me, Tony.
Well, we got a lot to talk about, so let's jump right into it. This week, President Obama laid out the country's challenges to Congress, put banks under a stress test, and unveiled his budget and health care plan. So, Sharice, his spending plan proposes higher taxes for the wealthy and universal health care. It also carries a $1.75 trillion deficit. Now, Republicans are attacking the plan for its spending and tax hikes. Even some blue dog Democrats aren't happy with it. So is this ideological and political divide the same as it was for Obama's stimulus package?
I think it's a little bit different because the numbers we're seeing are really kind of mounting and adding up. But I think that what Obama is betting on is that he has such goodwill. I mean, his poll ratings are in the high 50s to high 60s, depending on which poll you look at. He came in with a big margin of victory. And there's so much going on in the country right now that people are in the mood for innovation. So I think he figures that if he's going to go for some of these big items that he cares about, like education, reforming health care, energy, he's got to do it now or never. So he's just putting it all out there up front.
Aaron, you know, health care reform is an especially thorny issue because it calls for basically an overhaul of an entrenched health care system. Mm-hmm. Is it your view that Mr. Obama will ultimately be successful here because so many Americans are suffering with health care problems?
You know, I think he will. I hope he will. Although, you know, all the predictions out there are not very certain one way or the other, but what's clear is that our system's not working. He's not touting the single-payer plan, which, you know, I guess politically is just not possible even now. But I think that it will prevail because, particularly as people continue to lose jobs, lose their health care, as Obama said, you know, this is costing us a lot. It's a financial problem, and we just can't afford to have any more of that. So we've got to staunch the bleeding and excuse the metaphor. But I think that it will carry.
Here's another plan. The president announcing his intention to withdraw combat troops in Iraq by the summer of 2010. Plan has so far drawn mixed reviews, partly because of the disagreements over the best exit strategy for an unpopular war. But even with his plans, the U.S. would maintain a military presence there far longer, just not in a combat role. I heard today, Sharice, one Washington insider declared that effectively the president was announcing the end of the war. Is that what he's doing?
Well, he did. You know, he came out today with a few more details. I mean, I think people were a little bit concerned that the timeline went from 16 months to 18 months. But he basically said today at Camp Lejeune that by the end of 2011, American soldiers will be out of Iraq. I think what's concerning a lot of people is that they have to stay through December, through the parliamentary elections. And then even when he begins to withdraw them, the target date of August 2010, you're still going to have almost a third of the troops that are there now, 35,000 to 50,000 that are there. And is this semantics when you talk about, well, they'll just be there for security and for counterterrorism efforts? You know, what does that mean? I mean, they're still going to be in harm's way. But a lot of anti-war activists are trying to give him the benefit of the doubt.
Talking about perceptions, the Pentagon ban on media coverage of returning military coffins is ending, and today we saw some old photographs of coffins in papers like the New York Times. But it's a reminder of the power such photos have, Aaron, and under the newly lifted ban, we'll start seeing these pictures again pretty soon. What do you think the impact of this changed policy will be in terms of public reaction to the war, even as it winds down?
I think it will show us the human cost of the war, which we have not seen the last six, 7 years. And I'm actually kind of angry. I know that this ban has been in place since the early 90s, and in fact, I think it was instituted during the Vietnam War, it was attempted, but it didn't carry. But I really feel it's too little, too late. I mean, you know, we haven't seen any images. And in fact, the images of bodies coming back in coffins is a pretty sanitized one. We have not seen combat images and all those, the really gruesome things that actually helped stop the Vietnam War. So I'm glad that this is happening, but I'm annoyed that the press itself did not challenge this more in the last 7 years.
Let's move on to another topic. As I said, we have many to cover. We're going to try to get to as many of them as we can. As we said in the introduction today, the GOP is looking to the party's new talent as it rebuilds from last November's election losses. Republican governors, including Huckabee, Chris, Jindal, Pawlenty, and of course Palin, are names that we hear along with several other party hopefuls. Cherie, Saturday, tomorrow, the Conservative Political Action Conference will announce the results of its annual straw poll to see who should be the next GOP White House candidate. Who do you think is going to emerge?
You know, I think that Sarah Palin still has a lot of supporters. You know, Bobby Jindal has gotten a lot of attention, and clearly the fact that he was the one trotted out to give the rebuttal to Obama's speech shows that he's considered a real front runner. But, you know, it's anybody's guess, and in the end, it doesn't always matter. I mean, this is kind of a bellwether for who the conservatives support, but, you know, they didn't like John McCain. He came in fifth in the straw poll back in 2007. They wanted Mitt Romney, and McCain became the nominee. It's more a bellwether for how the conservatives feel, and that certainly can have an impact on whether or not you win the election in 2012.
Well, Aaron, if Obama is successful with his economic recovery package, does it matter who the GOP sends against him? And conversely, if he's not, won't that open the door for a more hardline, meaning conservative Republican?
Maybe not. I mean, if he's successful, then I think Republicans are dead in the water. But even if he isn't, I think people are starting to understand this is going to take a long time, this recovery, and it's starting to dawn on them that it was a long time in the making, and they're going to blame Republicans for that, even though I think it was a bipartisan. I think there's fault on both sides. But frankly, I don't think at this point, I think trying to name a front runner is premature. The Republicans have to regroup and figure out what they're about. They're not about, issue-wise, they're in real disarray. And, you know, I think they're hoping a personality might bring them together. But clearly, that is premature.
All right. General Motors has cut thousands of jobs, closed factories, received billions of dollars worth of government loans. Still, the troubled automaker just posted a $9.6 billion loss for its last quarter. Now, General Motors executives met with President Obama's auto industry task force yesterday, Cherise, but on Tuesday, the president made it clear he does not intend to let the U.S. auto industry die, but it just doesn't appear that there's an end in sight to the decline for Detroit, does it?
You know, I think the auto industry is really on life support. And one of the big problems is that they're just not making products that people, A, want, or B, can afford. I mean, you can cut all the jobs and cut the plants and stop selling Hummers, but if people can't get credit to buy a car, you're out of luck. So I think that there's going to be a lot of creative thinking in the next several weeks. GM says that they're going to be out of money by March if they don't get an infusion of cash. They're trying to make people that have bonds in the company, which is you and me, with our 401ks and IRAs, decide to take less money back for what we own, what our shares are. And people are saying, hey, let them go into bankruptcy. I want my money back. So there's a lot of competing interests. But Barack Obama has said we've got to keep the auto industry alive because too many people are dependent upon it.
You know, speaking of declining business, a major daily newspaper has printed its last edition, and another could be shutting down in a matter of weeks. Aaron, Denver's 150-year-old Rocky Mountain News ran its final edition today. San Francisco Chronicle could be next. Is this like the auto and banking industries, you know, where poor management practices have left these papers in the lurch?
I don't think it's quite the same. We're going to have some newspapers left, but it looks like every town will have one paper. I mean, Los Angeles, you know, has been that way a long time, and it's a huge market. You know what I have to say, what annoys me, I guess I'm very annoyed these days, is that the newspaper industry actually, they are, unlike the auto industry, is actually still running profits. I mean, just that the margins aren't as high as the old model wants them to be. And it's still the struggle with expectations. I don't think print will die. I mean, I just don't think so. But I think it does have to rethink its profit model, because that is just not going to work.
You know, you've worked at three different newspapers that I'm aware of, Charisse. What do you say briefly about this? Time's running out.
You know, I think that the industry is going through a major contraction. We're going to still be here, but there won't be as many. There won't be as many jobs. We talk about the auto industry. We're dependent on the auto industry for advertising. That's the reason why the money has dried up. And like Aaron said, you know, we are still making a profit, just not as great a profit. And we have to kind of get used to the new landscape. Our bubble has burst, just like real estate. But I think we'll survive because we have to. The country needs us.
We made it through almost every topic. There was one last one. I'm going to hit it really, really quickly because we have less than 30 seconds. The White House finally apparently deciding on a dog, a Portuguese water dog. Here's my question. Who's going to feed it, walk it, and clean up after it?
I think that's Malia and Sasha's job. Michelle Obama has not been playing on that one. So,
you know what? It's the kid's job, okay? That's what a dog is for.
Yeah,
but, you know,
right.
I have to applaud him. I have two rescue dogs myself. So, that's my good news for the week.
Well, it is the kids' job, but there are kids all over the country who are not doing their jobs.
Well,
we all
true.
Know that for sure. Thank you both. Charisse Jones is a national correspondent for USA Today, joining us from the studios of NPR in New York, and Aaron Aubrey Kaplan, a freelance writer and a contributing editor to the opinion page of the LA Times. This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. When esteemed cellist Yo-Yo Ma and violinist Yitzhak Perlman took the stage at President Obama's inauguration, some people saw it as more than just a prelude to a new administration. They saw it as a new beginning for arts in America. Today, we end our series on the Obama effect with a look at the president's policy on the arts. Later in the program, we'll hear from the legendary producer Quincy Jones, who wants the president to name an arts czar. But first, we look at the support for the arts financially and politically with Bob Lynch, president and CEO of Americans for the Arts, and Leslie King Hammond, director of the Center for Race and Culture and Dean Emeritus of Graduate Studies at Maryland Institute College of Art. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Leslie, I'm going to begin with you. The stimulus package allocated $50 million for the National Endowment for the Arts. Do you think that will be enough?
That is a beginning. It's an important beginning. And it is a recognition that Obama believes in the arts and the importance of the arts. So we are, of course, always looking for more, but we are ever so grateful that we have been recognized with what I would like to think of as some important seed money to begin this new process of establishing the arts in the forefront of America.
Well, Bob, in these tough economic times, some would say that the arts should be low on the list of institutions that need funding when compared to health care, joblessness, and the war. How can funding for the arts compete as necessary when we're in a recession?
Well, those people who would say that don't really quite understand the role of the arts in America, because the arts are part of the driving economic force. Over 4% of the businesses in America are arts-related businesses, and 100,000 nonprofit arts organizations out there creating a $166 billion economic impact, 5.7 million jobs. So on the jobs front, there's really important information. But at the same time, a lot of the work of the arts connects to things like community development, downtown revitalization, health issues, hospital improvement, and on and on. The data is all there. Better education, retention rates, youth at risk improved. So what we have to do in the arts is make a better case and an ongoing case of what is actually obvious if people just look around.
Well, Leslie, some people oppose government funding of the arts because they oppose tax dollars going to controversial artists like Andreas Serrano, who infamously photographed a crucifix in urine in the 1980s. Is that a legitimate concern given the climate that we're in?
No, I don't think it's a legitimate concern. But I think what we have to recognize is that we are now in a new era, and we need very important new problem solvers. And artists are abstract thinkers. The idea of choosing an Andreas Serrano, who supposedly provoked the society with his choice of subject matter, does not talk to the real issue, which is that we need abstract thinkers, right-brain thinkers, creative thinkers to create new solutions for new problems, because the old issues, the old models have not worked. And it is time for us to use all the resources of this country. And we have not looked to the artists, the artistic community, to help us solve and create the country that Obama and the rest of America and the world is looking to see realized.
You know, Bob, Leslie raises an interesting point. Isn't art best supported from the ground up, like the kind of grassroots political movements that swept Barack Obama into office, community galleries, theaters, and the like?
Well, I think what's important to understand is that is the way it's supported. You take a look at those 100,000 nonprofit arts organizations that I mentioned and that Americans for the Arts tracks, and you'll see that half their money comes from earned income. That's people like you and me paying to come to something or buying something from them. Another 40% of their money comes from private donations, mostly individuals, again, like you and me. And the final 10% is government money, but most of that is local government money investing in advancing the arts locally. The federal money is a tiny piece, less than a percentage of 1%, but it's a lever that actually helps create a flow of all the other dollars that creates this wonderful $166 billion nonprofit industry.
How does, Leslie, America stack up globally in terms of its government support for the arts? I'm thinking now just of the story in today's paper about how upset China is over the auctioning off of some sculptures that were in the possession of the late Yves Saint Laurent.
Well, we have to recognize that America is the youngest country on the face of the earth, and that America is an amalgam of so many other cultures. And because America was structuring itself, it did not have the same kind of structuring system wherein the arts were prioritized as in the other cultures globally, which have a legacy back to ancestral times, where arts was the priority in life to maintain the integrity and the heritage and the character of that culture, of that civilization. So now that as we build America to be the civilization, to be the global power that we envision ourselves to be, and to be part of the global network, we have to also pay equal homage to our artists who are so important in establishing the criteria for who we are and how we will be leaders and partners in solving the global crisis.
Well, Bob, which segments of the arts tend to be supported most? Music, visual arts, performing arts, and why?
Well, and before I jump in on that, I'd just say that the other thing comparing us internationally is that our system is completely different than all the other systems, which are largely government-supported. Ours is not a support system. It's an incentive system. And a little more incentive, and you would see massive additional blossoming of private donation and individual support. Now, the kinds of art forms that get supported, sometimes you see more money going into the kinds of things that have facilities. Doesn't matter what the art form is. It could be music, it could be theater, it could be dance, but facility investment tends to end up being a chunk of dollars that takes away. And sometimes on the other end of the spectrum, the art forms that don't require a lot of materials, let's say like poetry, for example, get less. But across the board, it really is a community decision. I just was in Los Angeles, San Jose, San Francisco, New York, and I'm headed out to Nevada this week. Each of these places emphasizes different things in their own particular community arts portfolio, and I think that's the beauty of the American system.
Here's my final question, and our segment is coming to an end. I appreciate both of you coming on and sharing your thoughts with us. Is it fair to suggest that President Obama's approach to the arts is a positive one and that it in some ways differs or improves upon that of his predecessor, George Bush? Leslie?
Well, I think that what we have witnessed from the inauguration, even from the outset during his campaigning, and certainly just recently the other night in awarding Stevie Wonder one of the most cherished awards, is that he is building on the tradition and legacy, and he is clearly going to expand the legacy of how a presidential positioning will enhance and partner with the arts to build a nation and to reinforce all of those things that we hope to see move to enhance our understanding of how the arts improve the quality of life in this country.
All right, our time is out. I appreciate both of you for appearing with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bob Lentz is the president and CEO of Americans for the Arts. He joined us from NPR headquarters in Washington. And Leslie King Hammond is the director of the Center for Race and Culture and Dean Emeritus of Graduate Studies at Maryland Institute College of Art. It began with Al Gore's candidacy in 2000, but it was President Obama's White House campaign that forever changed the way politicians view the Internet. Social networking, online coalition building, and Internet fundraising have become the new model for future politics and grassroots organizing. We continue now with our discussion of the Obama effect with a look at the evolutionary use of technology. Joining us, we have Omar Wasso, the contributing writer for TheRoot.com, and Nathan Henderson James, an online communication coordinator for grassroots organization ACORN. Omar, Nathan, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Omar, let's start with you. Many media outlets are eager to call President Obama the tech president. His campaign used real-time new media tools to help get out the vote. His website was even created by Facebook co-founder Chris Hughes. What were some of the trailblazing online tactics that the Obama administration enacted which changed the game of campaigning?
Well, they did a number of things that really broke new ground. Among other things, as you mentioned, launching their own social network. They really sort of harnessed kind of grassroots activism so that it wasn't just them pushing out activities, but they let their sort of enthusiastic members of the social network organize their own fundraisers, organize their own events to support the campaign. They really pushed a lot of power out to the margins, which is really how the Internet itself works at its best. It's much more bottom-up. And they did this across the board while also doing an enormous amount of email so that they were able to generate 3 million donors online for 6.5 million donations and over $500 million.
Well, Nathan, speaking of bottom-up, many of the people in your organization that your organization works with are from low-income backgrounds. How does social networking play a role in community organizing?
That's a really good question, and I think that, you know, our constituency is really still on the wrong side of the digital divide. Certainly, email is a lot more got a lot more penetration than it has before, but it's still not going to be the same kind of thing that you've seen in an Obama effect. But one of the interesting things that you do see is that there's a lot of cell phone penetration, and I think that the future of social networking for our constituency is actually in text messaging.
You know, Omar, the new Republican National Committee Chairman Michael Steele has promised to use Internet technology more effectively for his party going forward. Are there any new ideas left with regard to developing a high-tech campaign?
Well, I think one of the interesting things about this last campaign was that there was this stark divide between what Obama was doing as compared with what both Hillary Clinton and John McCain were doing. They were both just entirely outclassed technically by what Obama did. And I don't think we'll ever see a gap that substantial in any future presidential campaign. So there's a lot of room for the next Republican presidential candidate to simply duplicate what Obama has done, and that will, even in closing that gap, by a fraction, it will help a lot. I mean, even John McCain, I was looking at his Twitter page today, he had almost no tweets, no messages sent out during the campaign, and now he's doing it, you know, sort of hourly. And so, I mean, even he's caught up since the campaign ended. So I don't know that there need to be new ideas as much as kind of duplicating the success that was demonstrated.
Nathan, let's talk about ACORN for a moment, because your organization made headlines last year for allegations of voter registration fraud. We don't want to revisit that issue, but I do want to ask this question. How susceptible are grassroots organizations to abuses vis-a-vis the Internet when promoting a candidate or a cause?
Well, if by abuses you mean attacks from folks who are not interested in doing what you're wanting to do, I think one of the things that the Internet does is allow many more people to have a piece of the conversation and for that conversation to come in from very many quarters. So I would say that it really facilitates the ability of folks to kind of talk back to what you're doing.
Omar, in some lower income areas, you touched on this briefly and so did Nathan, libraries, schools, even some community centers offer free internet access. But oftentimes, these very same communities don't know how to use the internet as a resource, and they're not taking full advantage of it. Is that changing, though? And in what ways is that attitude toward access changing?
I think what I would say is that the internet is not fundamentally changing the degree to which low-income people who may be more focused on their sort of urgent priorities of work and home and health are being able to participate online. But what it does do is it lowers the cost of participating so that people who might have been middle class who weren't participating, people who were lower middle class who might not have had the energy to kind of engage, it allows those people at the margin to become more involved. And so it's not a radical transformation, but it is evolutionary that it's not just people making big checks showing up at big fundraisers. It's people who are inspired by something they see on TV, going to a website and clicking through. And I think we should remember that while 40% of Americans are offline on a regular basis, that is to say, aren't online on a regular basis, there's a substantial majority of 60%. And it's that block of 60% that are getting engaged politically.
You know what's interesting, Nathan, also is the fact that you talk about there not being as high a level of engagement with the internet in these communities, but at the same time, in these very same communities, everybody's on the telephone, everybody's texting. How is that disconnect made?
Well, I mean, that is absolutely the future of engagement on what we're currently calling online. All of these devices, all these capabilities are going to converge in your phone. You're going to be able to surf the web much more easily. You're going to be able to get email, text messaging. So that is where we're going to go. And I think that when that happens over the next 5-10 years, you're going to see, you know, it's not going to be 60% anymore. It's going to be 80-85%. You're going to see a lot more engagement from those folks. And really what that does is it helps those communities have a voice, especially when they're working through organizations like Acorn that can kind of collectivize those voices and have an influence on political debates and policy debates and those kinds of things.
Our time is up, Omar, but I do want to ask you really quickly just to answer this. Is Obama going to go down as the tech president?
I think he is clearly the first internet president and has transformed not only American politics, but politics around the world by the model he has produced.
It's an interesting thing because actually Al Gore was the person who sort of got this ball rolling, wasn't it? And yet Obama seems to be the person who is going to really capitalize on the reputation from
Obama
that.
Won.
Well, that's a very good point. Gentlemen, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Omar Wasso is a contributing writer for TheRoot.com, and Nathan Henderson James is online communication coordinator for the grassroots organization Acorn. Nathan joined us here in the studios of NPR West. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. It's Friday, so we get to touch on the lighter side of things today. To that end, our own maven of the entertainment beat, I like that, Allison Samuels, right here in the studio with me. Hey, Allison.
Hey, Tony. The Oscars took place last weekend, and they were fairly predictable, as expected. But something surprising did happen over the weekend.
I guess nobody told you that I'm Madea, Ma to the damn D-E-H.
That's right. Tyler Perry's Madea Goes to Jail was a box office hit this weekend, raking in over $41 million. And ABC gave a preview of their new mid-season replacement shows at the end of the Academy Awards, and we didn't see one person of color. Joining me to discuss all of this is NPR correspondent Karen Grigsby Bates. Hi, Karen.
Hey, Allison. Hi, Tony.
Madea Goes to Jail is in stark contrast with the films we saw honored by the Academy Awards. Do you think Hollywood is still surprised when Tyler Perry makes so much money?
I think they've stopped being surprised because he's made a couple of movies before now, and they made gobs of money. And they kept looking and saying, how could this happen? How could this happen? Well, the reason this happened is that Tyler doesn't leave the marketing up to somebody else. He goes out, and he is very hands-on about this. He's kind of like President Obama was in terms of marketing through the internet. I'm always getting emails from Tyler Perry saying, God be blessed. My movie's doing great. Please go out and see it if you haven't already. Take your grandmother. So that's why he made $40 million.
Well, also, $40 million, that's a lot. Is that just African-Americans or is that crossover?
You know, there may be a little bit of crossover. I still think that the rest of the world outside the black community in general isn't quite getting Tyler Perry yet, but they don't need to when he's making that kind of money. And I think, frankly, he's been so good at marketing that all you need is a couple of mega churches saying, okay, after brunch, we're going to go see Tyler Perry. And there you go. And ka-ching, $40 million.
Is that why he's been so successful? I mean, is that the key to success, just sort of knowing how to promote and who to promote to?
You know, I interviewed him a couple of years ago when I was on Day to Day, when Madea Goes to Jail was actually a play here in the Kodak Theater, and it was fuller than the Kodak was on Oscars night. There was not one empty seat. People had saved up. They were coming. And the reason they came, he firmly believes the reason they came is that he doesn't talk down to them, that he's doing theater that he says his relatives would like to see. And in this case, movies that his relatives would like to see, because he says, you know, I go see Hamlet. I go see, you know, serious stuff. My relatives ain't going to see that. They want something more fun. And so this is what people want.
Well, it's interesting because Hollywood has a history when something works, they try to duplicate it. But this seems like this would be a little harder to duplicate because he developed such a core audience over the course of years. This didn't happen overnight.
Although he's not the first black guy in a dress. I mean, if you look back to Flip Wilson, to Jamie Foxx, to
Martin Lawrence,
the Wayans brothers, you know, there's been this has gone on for a while. For some reason, we think men in dresses is pretty funny. And, you know, as black folks, we think men in dresses can be very funny. I've heard some women object to what Madea actually looks like. They think that Tyler's gone over the top with the huge breasts and the huge booty and all the rest of that, but people still go to see it.
Well, I was wondering, though, with his success over the last few years, why we haven't seen Hollywood embrace, because he had a hard time getting a deal early on.
Oh, yeah.
Do you think the next guy who has that same type of sort of plan, do you think he'll have an easier time because of a Tyler Perry?
Maybe marginally, but I'm a cynic when it comes to Hollywood, and I don't think so. You know, if you think back to the movie Hollywood Shuffle, when they had all these actors from the Royal Dramatic Academy with reading their resumes, and the producers were saying, well, what we're really looking for is somebody who's more like an Eddie Murphy, Murphy-ronic. I don't know if they're going to look for somebody who's Tyler Perrick out there. They may feel like as long as he's producing prolifically, and he is, they don't need another one, but they may be looking for the next thing after Tyler Perry.
Okay.
I mean, you know, a couple of years ago, Jeff Zucker told me Tracy Morgan was going to be the biggest black star I'd ever seen, thanks to the Tracy Morgan Show that was going to start on NBC. And that lasted for how long? And where did he go after that?
Right. That's a good next question. I mentioned that after the Oscars, they did a big clip showing all the mid-season replacement shows. And there wasn't one face of color on any of the clips. And I'm wondering, in this day of Obama, how can we still be in that same place where we can put shows on national television and still not have a minority on them?
Well, number one, the brother's only been in office for about 5 weeks and he's doing the economy first. He can't fix everything.
Well, that's true.
But number two, I think the shows that did have black presence are shows that either have black runners or directors or somebody up high on the food chain that has the sensibility to say, look, the world outside this box looks a different kind of way. And if we have this monochromatic cast and crew, then after a while, people are going to go away. So I think that your big successes, for instance, have been the ensemble shows, the cop shows, the forensic shows, the Grey's Anatomy, its spinoff, Private Practice. And now Grey's and Private have a black showrunner, Shonda Rhimes. But these other shows, a lot of the ensemble shows often have black directors or black producers. There's some black sensibility in there somewhere.
But to your point of he just got into office, he ran a campaign for 2 years that brought on race as a subject, you know, frequently. So you would think the producers and directors would have sort of figured out people are interested in this.
Let's think about the world the producers and the directors live in. You know, when they go home, they go home to largely segregated neighborhoods. They have circles of friends that are in the business, which means they're mostly looking at white people when they go to these parties. And, you know, the few black and brown and yellow faces that are there are sort of their foray into the world of color. This is my Asian friend, Janice. This is my black friend, so-and-so. I mean, they don't say that, but it's pretty clear that these are, you know, that these are isolated incidences.
One last quick question. Reality shows do have their share of African Americans on them, sometimes not shown in the most positive of lights. But what do you think? Is that good or bad, or how is that going to sort of expand?
You know, I don't have a problem with reality shows because I think they are equal opportunity humiliators. You know, you can be white, rich, and clueless on Real Housewives of Orange County, or you can be black, rich, and clueless on Real Housewives of Atlanta, and you still look pretty stupid at the end of the day. So as long as they're not singling people of color out to be their example of chromatic stupidity, I'm okay with it.
So equal opportunity stupidity?
Equal opportunity stupidity. Now, I'd like for us to move in the other direction and have some equal opportunity showcasing and some equal opportunity depth of character. But if they're doing unidimensional and everybody's unidimensional, I don't care if we've got all different color cartoons up there.
Okay. And that from the way it looks, that is sort of where we're getting our work. African-Americans is on the reality shows. So that is one bright spot.
Reality and teeny cable. One hopes that when Oprah's network starts up that there'll be some more work for people of color. But, you know, right now it's not looking so good.
Well, thank you, Karen. That was NPR correspondent Karen Grigsby Bates. She joined me here at the studios of NPR West.
Earlier in the show, we talked about the importance of the arts, even in an economic downturn. Well, that's a subject dear to the heart of music impresario Quincy Jones. Jones learned early on about the impact American artists have not only on the country, but on the world. In the mid-50s, Jones was part of the Dizzy Gillespie big band, and the State Department sent them on a goodwill tour around the globe. It was during the Cold War, and President Eisenhower wanted to spread the ideals of American democracy as a weapon against communism. As part of our Living Legends series, this is Quincy Jones on life as a representative of American culture.
We were the kamikaze black band. We went up and down to Tehran when the Shah was in there in 56, you know. In Aleppo, Damascus, Karachi, even Iraq, Bangladesh, Dhaka, Beirut, Ankara, Istanbul. The young rebels from Cyprus were throwing stones at the U.S. embassies. Get the Gillespie band over there, the kamikaze band. We were there 2 days from Ankara, Turkey, and we played a concert in Athens. All of those student rebels were in the audience. They rushed the stage after we finished. Scared us to death. They put Dizzy on their shoulder and they were saying, Dizzy, Dizzy, because the music has a power, you know, it's different. And we went into Beirut, we saw, oh my God, it must have been 10,000 people there, and it was for Dizzy. You have to go to know, that's all I'm trying to say, really. To see how the world is operating on simultaneously is the most fascinating thing in the world. I've been lucky, I think, because I got a chance to get out of the country when I was 19 with Lionel Hampton. And Ben Webster, you know, the jazz saxophone player? I talk a lot now, but I used to listen when I was young, a lot. And I'd never had a mother, so I had to listen, you know. And Ben Webster said, Youngblood, every country you go to, eat the food the people eat, listen to the music they listen to, and learn 30 or 40 words in every language, because music, food, and language is the soul of a country, you know. That's why I'm so anxious for us to get a Secretary of the Arts, or Minister of Culture, if you will, you know, because our music is the most widely imitated music on the planet. When Ben said about learning, when Webster said about learning language, I took it very seriously, you know. I studied Serbo-Croatian, Farsi, and Iran. You want to get pimp slapped. You call an Iranian Arabic. I am Persian. I'm not Arabic. And I speak Farsi, you know. Turkish, Greek, French, Swedish, Russian. I studied katakana in Japan. I'm studying Mandarin now, writing and speaking Mandarin and Arabic. But it's the most incredible experience in the world to learn. You start with a few, and you start to grow. And after a while, you just don't have to drag your culture into everybody else's culture. And that's been one of our problems. You know? It's trying to make everybody like us.
You're listening to the musings of music impresario Quincy Jones. Today, Jones is a man of the world, traveling constantly and mingling with the rich and famous. But he didn't start out that way. He was born in Chicago in 1933. That's where he was first introduced to music and to life's hard knocks.
And man, believe me, Chicago makes Compton and Harlem look like Boys Town. They don't play, as you can see now. With the governor, they don't play. They never did play. It has been the spawning ground for gangsters since the beginning of the country. And it's at a stockyard in the middle of the town when we were little kids, you know. And all I saw were Tommy guns and stogies and piles of money, dead bodies everywhere. Dudes hanging on lampposts in the hood, ice picks in their necks, two-gun peeps shooting kids in the back, you know. Teachers getting killed in the hallways every day. I mean, they didn't play. I got my own medals there. I went in the wrong street. They nailed my hand with a switchblade to the fence. I didn't know how to interpret it. My daddy hit him in the head with a hammer and all that stuff. I was on the wrong street. He used to send us down to Louisville to stay with my grandmother, who was an ex-slave in the shotgun shack. And we always kid and said my grandmother's summer villa. No heat, no water, no electricity, kerosene lamps, coal stove, and all this stuff, you know. My grandmother's barn, French and Cherokee, African, French and Cherokee. My grandfather was running a brothel for some white dudes down there, and at one point they wanted to put my mother and all her sisters in the brothel house. Stole a car and took them to St. Louis. That's the way it was back then. One of the biggest painful things in my life now is that this country, the kids, especially the black kids, don't have a clue about their culture. Not a clue. Because you can go get to where you're going if you know where you came from. You know, from gospel, blues, jazz, all of it. That nobody met, no one person invented gospel. It's a sociological result, you know, of a really painful existence, you know. So it's a sociological phenomenon. But now, it hurts me to see that everybody in the world has adopted our music as their Esperanto. Everywhere. I mean without fail, you know, whether it's Jimmy's in Monte Carlo, Rio, Cairo, wherever, Shanghai. It's been all these places 3 times in the last 2 years. I asked a kid in Seattle, a little brother, what do you thought about Louis Armstrong? He said, I heard his name. I said, what do you think about Charlie Parker, Coltrane, and Duke Ellington? He said, I don't know who they are. It hurts. It really hurts. This is all about our lives in this country, you know, really. It's a society that gets rejected, and instead of hell with it, we build our own society, you know. And it's been like that all the way, you know, since Louis Armstrong. To me, I look at life through my core skill, which is orchestrator, arranger, and composer, you know. And in the beginning, it was 4 trumpets, 4 trombones, 5 saxes, piano, bass, drum, and guitar. That's what makes every big band happen. And that's the power of music, you know. Because it's absolute, just like mathematics are. But music is the only thing that affects the left and right brain simultaneously. And it's fascinating, and you have to just constantly keep nosy.
the one and only Quincy Jones. He has a new book out. It's called The Complete Quincy Jones, My Journey and Passions, Photos, Letters, Memories, and More from Q's Personal Collection. That's News and Notes. Glad you could be with us. Nicole Childers, Christabel and Sia Boati, and Jeffrey Bennett produced the show. Sasha Woodruff is the editor, and Sonata Lee Narsis directs. The technical director is Shireen Strausberg. Marcia Caldwell is our drive engineer. The News and Notes staff includes Roy Hurst, Jeffrey Gardner, Devin Robbins, Allison Samuel, Zachary Slobig, Joanne Griffith, and Drew Tewksbury. To listen to the show or subscribe to the podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for the newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. On Monday, General Motors posts historic fourth quarter losses and plans to lay off tens of thousands more. Is that well-traveled path to the black middle class closed for good? Tony Cox, this is News and Notes.